You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Parents of kids in school have always faced the question, how involved should I be in my kids' education? Should I talk to teachers more? Show up for parent-teacher conferences more? Am I getting too involved? And teachers face a range of situations, from parents who don't or can't get involved much at all to so-called helicopter parents who won't let go. Then we had COVID and distance learning shaking everything up, plus some high-profile political issues over parental control flared up at school board meetings around the country. Our next guests are with us for a look at some of the best ways for parents, teachers, and administrators to work together for the best outcomes for students. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a parent, how involved are you in your child's education? What kind of relationships do you have with your students' teachers? If you're on the teacher side of things, what are you seeing and hearing or not seeing and hearing from your students' parents? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Valerie Craig is an assistant professor of educational studies at UW-La Crosse, where she researches family engagement and education. Val, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
And Jessica Calarco is an associate professor of sociology at UW-Madison. She's an expert on inequalities in education and family life. Jess, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Jess, can you start by talking about the role parents play in a child's education? Why is it important? What kind of benefits do we get when parents have at least some kind of open line of communication with teachers in the process?
Sure. I mean, we know that schools can't do everything, and that especially in our society, we task schools with solving huge social problems. And so that's often, you know, more than the resources that we give them to handle. And so in that kind of a context, the role that families play outside of the classroom and sometimes even in the classroom can be tremendously important for everything from helping kids to feel supported and welcome and part of the classroom environment to making sure that kids are getting access to the resources and support that they need to be successful. So there's lots of different ways that parents matter that we can talk about, that there's different ways for parents to get involved, and those different types of involvement versus interventions can have different consequences, both positive and negative on those fronts too.
Val, can you talk about, paint us a picture of what a good working relationship could look like in a school where teachers and parents are working together in a positive way?
Oh, sure. So a good relationship is a partnership. So it's working together for the benefit of a child. It starts with sending a child to school ready to learn. So everything from making sure a child is rested and fed breakfast and ready to go to communicating about what the child needs, what the child's learning needs are. Is the child getting what they need at school? What can the child do to support those needs? And what is the school needing from the parents? And it goes from there.
And Jess, you mentioned the communication, the coordination can have different forms. What are some of the different ways that the different methods that can work here?
Sure. So we can think about, on the one hand, there's involvement, which is kind of some of the things that Val was talking about in terms of making sure the kids are ready for school, understanding, helping out even in the classroom, helping out with activities. And I think there's ways to help with homework there in classes where homework is assigned. And we can contrast that with other things, what I would call maybe intervention, where parents are intervening, contacting teachers, contacting other school officials with the goal of helping their child navigate a specific situation. Maybe it's getting testing, maybe it's asking for changes to the classroom environment, getting extra support, or even asking for a teacher's advice around a particular issue. And so those two different ways of getting involved, and there's even more than that that we could think of, you know, can have different consequences, in part because of with intervention, it's much more individualized, whereas involvement is often about the classroom environment as a whole, or at least is oftentimes geared around the kinds of larger goals that teachers might have. Intervention is often more about what the parent is thinking about in terms of the individual child. And so those different dimensions can lead to some different outcomes.
And Val, with an intervention, I mean, sometimes it can at least start off looking like a conflict, a difficult conversation. The parent thinks something needs to be different, needs to be happening in the school. They view the teacher as not doing that or getting in the way. How can we take that starting point where it's a point of conflict and work toward a good outcome?
That's a good question. So it can be hard for a parent to come to terms with the fact that a child is having a difficult time. So, but I think when when a parent recognizes, it starts with a relationship. So it starts with the parent recognizing that the teacher does indeed want what's best for that, for the child. So coming to a common understanding that everybody wants what's best for the child, and figuring out together what that is the starting point, and then building from that point.
Talking to Val Craig at UW La Crosse, Assistant Professor of Educational Studies, and Jess Calarco, Associate Professor of Sociology at UW-Madison, looking at coordinating, working together, parents, teachers, school districts, for the best interests of the kid. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your experience as a student, a teacher, or a parent. Again, 800-642-1234. Val, I cut you off there. I realized as I started talking, you had some more to say about the next steps in resolving that conflict, I think.
It's okay. It's all, I was just saying, it all begins with a relationship. Without relationship, nothing else can happen.
And Jess, you look at inequalities in access to schools in some ways, and you can imagine, you know, some parents, their work schedule might be flexible, or they might have a job where they could take time off. They have the means to show up at that, parent-teacher conference or what have you. What can schools do to make sure that as many people as possible have that kind of access, even if their lives and schedules don't permit those traditional forms?
Sure. I mean, I think there's certainly things we can do on the scheduling front to make sure that key events are happening at times when as many parents can be involved as possible. But I think we also have to acknowledge that there's always going to be inequalities in who can show up at school and who can be part of events. And so finding alternative ways to get parents involved through digital means, for example, or through outreach, and also being understanding of parents who can't play that kind of a role and putting in place oftentimes public resources or school-based resources to help students navigate those kinds of situations where their parents can't be involved. So I do some research around homework, for example, and I found that in some conditions, teachers and other educators will judge students whose parents can't be involved, and can, in some cases, penalize students who aren't getting that kind of support at home. And I think that's a risk that we have because of these kinds of inequalities in parents' ability to be involved, whether that's on the language front in terms of helping kids with homework or in terms of their work schedules. And so I think schools have to be mindful of those inequalities and think about how they structure that into policies around things like homework, either by, some schools have opted to forgo homework and other schools have opted to put in place things like after-school programs to make it possible for students to get support from trained educators who can help with those kinds of assignments outside of the classroom. So I think there's ways that schools can help to address those disparities, even if they can't fully fix the disparities themselves.
Val, I want to go to the opposite extreme now. We sometimes hear about, helicopter parents who do too much for their kids. I don't know how common that really is or how much of that is, us in the media making a thing. That said, is there a point where parents are trying to overmanage their kids' school experience?
Yes, there is a point where that happens. Yes, there is.
And what could that look like? What kind of impact could that have on kids? Maybe a bad impact could that have on a kid, contrary to their parents' intention?
So, yeah, and the point you make of parents being well-intended is a good one, because it is definitely coming from a point of parents wanting the best for their children. But what can happen is children who don't learn to be resilient or to have initiative or to do things for themselves because they have parents who are solving all of their problems for themselves. So we end up with children who get into high school or even college who have learned that their parents will rescue them from adversity. So we need children to be able to deal with their own problems, small problems for small children, and then bigger problems for bigger children. And so well-meaning parents do not do their children any favors when they swoop in and solve all of their problems for them.
We're talking about how to develop healthy educational relationships, partnerships between parents, teachers, and students and school districts to promote learning. We have Jessica Larco from UW-Madison's Sociology Department with us and Val Craig, UW-La Crosse Educational Studies Professor. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you work in schools, have you found ways to make this kind of contact more accessible for parents? If you're a parent, is there something that you wish had worked differently somewhere along the way in your kid's school experience where that partnership could have worked better? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our conversation about parent and teacher relationships and involvement in students' educations. Our guests are UW-La Crosse Educational Studies Professor Valerie Craig and UW-Madison Sociology Professor Jessica Calarco. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. I'd love to hear from parents and teachers or maybe even students out there about what works, what doesn't work. If you felt comfortable getting involved, say, with your kid's school in one way or another, were there obstacles for you? Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to a caller now. Maeve is with us in Janesville. Maeve, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up?
I want to bring up conversation about racial awareness and racism that I see exists on many levels in the schools. I don't know if you've covered this in your conversation today or not. I'm very familiar with schools in Madison, Janesville, and Milwaukee as a parent and as a grandparent. I'm a white mom with black kids and black grandchildren. And I see the completely ignoring conversations about race to be of great detriment to my children and to all children. And I hope this gets entered into the conversations that you're having today.
Maeve, thanks a lot for bringing that up. Jess, your thoughts, gaps in racial understanding or unequal access to these kind of partnerships based on race, as Maeve is bringing up. What do you think?
Sure. I mean, research shows that there is a disproportionate tendency in schools to leave race underaddressed, especially in an explicit way when it comes to conversations in the curriculum, in part because there's a fear among some white parents that white kids will be uncomfortable talking about race and racism, despite the fact that we know that it's helpful for young kids to understand the realities of our society and helpful to talk about those ideas in a space that is comfortable and familiar to them with their peers, and certainly helpful for kids of color to be able to have those conversations and to understand and to see that their peers are learning about the kinds of realities that they may face in their day-to-day lives and that historically have shaped our communities and our schools as well. And so I think there's certainly a reason to include those kinds of conversations in the curriculum, despite the fact that they are often sidelined. And I think we can certainly help teachers to feel empowered to do so. We're in a political environment right now where there's a lot of threats when it comes to talking about race in the curriculum. And so I can certainly understand why teachers would be hesitant to have those conversations. But I think we need to make sure that teachers are empowered to follow the best practice on those fronts.
Maeve, thanks a lot for that call. And Val, that reminds me, some of your work, we were just talking about race there, some of your work also focuses on poverty and economic differences in education. How can teachers, how can school districts recognize and work with students who are coming from a background of poverty?
Oh, well, it's tough. We know about the achievement gap and how our children of poverty come to school, you know, a bit behind the ball as far as their language and literacy learning and other areas. And we're talking about parent engagement, and often our parents of poverty face many barriers to being engaged in their children's learning. And some of my research found that those folks want to be engaged, but they feel intimidated, among other barriers. They feel they don't have anything to offer. They feel that they don't know how to be engaged. So we need to reach out to those folks. We need to tell them we want them to be involved either in the school, or we need to help them understand they have things to offer at home as well, whether that's just having conversations with their children about what they're learning or reading with their children or even talking about their day, or we need to embrace them. So every family has the capacity to support their child's learning. So it is our role as educators to help families to recognize and to develop that capacity.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Mary is with us now in Milwaukee. Mary, hi.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Good. So I am an educator. I'm in my second year teaching, and I absolutely love it so far. And I teach younger kids, like 3 and 4 year olds. And I think the biggest issue kind of that I run into is the lack of parent involvement in their children's education. When the parents come in and their child is showing them something they made or new letters that they can recognize or things like that, the parents just seem to not care. And I think that is just one of the saddest things as a teacher to witness. And I'm just curious, is that something that you guys are seeing a rise of in more recent years, or is this kind of an issue where the parents don't care across the board, you know, for all of time?
Mary, thanks for the call. I'll throw that to each of you. Jess, is this something that a concern? Are parents getting less invested in their kids' education, or maybe that Mary's just got a sample size that is giving a bad answer to her?
I mean, I think we have to be mindful of the fact that parents are under a great deal of stress right now, that we live in a society that is plagued on so many fronts by economic precarity, by political instability. I think there's a lot that parents are contending with right now, especially when it comes to paid work that demands on, parents who are working for pay are higher than ever before in terms of expectations of being on call, working long hours, being constantly on our phones to be ready to fill in that assignment for our bosses or for our employers. And I think that puts a tremendous amount of stress on families to be able to have the time and the energy to devote to their kids' learning in a way that, especially for families where all the parents are involved in the paid, or all the family members who are in the child's life are involved in the paid workforce, and there isn't someone at home. I mean, this is work that disproportionately falls to mothers, and thinking about how if mom is also working for pay full time, that's, essentially 2 full-time jobs that they're being expected to do. And so I think we have to be mindful of the demands that we're putting on families, and thinking about not only how can we structure family school relationships, but also structure family work relationships in ways that can make it more possible for families to be involved in their kids' lives in meaningful and sustainable ways.
Mary, thanks for the call. And Val, I think I heard you nodding along with that. Do you have some thoughts on how to bridge the gap with parents who are, as Jess says, under, in many cases, a lot of stress?
Yeah, I would echo those sentiments as well. And simply celebrate the fact that the parent is there with the child, and look for those small successes. The parent is there, the child is presumably ready to learn, rested, clothed, and perhaps look for those small opportunities to perhaps integrate yourself. And yes, look at those letters that she is showing you, and perhaps model how to respond in those situations, and see that as a teaching moment for the parent, because we are teaching in some of those instances not only the child but the parent. We're role models for them as well. We have to remember the background. It's a system, and using a systemic approach to modeling for it. Mary. For the entire family.
Thanks again for the call, Mary. Jim is with us now in Milwaukee. Jim, hi.
Hello, everybody. Hey, I think parents in general are disenchanted with the school system. I don't believe they, I know they don't think it's a very strong institution, and it's kind of hard to take serious. What seems to be happening with teachers is they're bored with teaching math and science and history and the things they need to know. And they're more focused on their lives, diversity. They want to control their lives and change their lives in some kind of meaningful way without, that seems like the priority. And then the secondary thing to worry about is actually what they're being taught of in school, the base.
I gotcha, Jim. Thanks for the call. Jess, Jim's thought that there's too much of the social side of things and not enough on the education anymore.
And then I think here I would say the kids have to feel safe and secure in order to learn any academic curriculum. And so really we have to pay attention to the social and emotional pieces when it comes to kids learning. We have to make sure that kids feel like they are part of a learning environment, that they are trusted by their teachers, that they trust their peers. And so I think really we have to keep those pieces in the curriculum in order to make sure that students are in a place, especially in the wake of the pandemic, in the wake of the, you know, the societal challenges that we've faced over the last couple of years. We need to make sure that kids are able to be resilient in the face of those challenges and in a place where they can effectively learn. And so I'm very grateful to teachers who are taking the time to keep those elements in the curriculum and not just push to focus on back to basics when it comes to school.
Thanks for that call, Val. Just in our last half minute, we mentioned many parents are stressed. We know many teachers are stressed. Can you leave us with a half minute of encouragement for teachers, even under that stress, to try to keep these open lines of communication with parents?
Yes, all I will say is I know many, many excellent teachers. They are doing great work. They are meeting the needs of children, as Jess said, coming out of the pandemic. They are creating safe spaces for children. They are doing great things. I admire them all.
We'll leave it there. Val, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Jessica, glad you could be with us.
Thanks.
Been talking to Jessica Calarco, Associate Professor of Sociology at UW-Madison, and Valerie Craig, Assistant Professor of Educational Studies at UW-La Crosse. They were with us today to talk about the importance of parental involvement in a child's education and a healthy relationship between parents and teachers. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, would our roads be safer if cars had some kind of automatic high-speed limits built in? We'll check out a proposal that's still in the very early stages and the impact it might have if it comes to fruition. And there's a new report out on book challenges, removals, and bans in schools and libraries around the country. We'll check out the latest data from the group PEN America. You can join in with your thoughts and let us know what you're seeing in your own school district, in your own community. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Does it ever seem to you like the clothing you buy doesn't last as long as it did back in the day? If so, you are not alone. Maybe you've even thought they don't make them like they used to. If so, you're not wrong. Today, we're buying more clothes than ever in history, and the lifespan of individual garments is shrinking. The fashion industry has seen many changes to how clothes are made over the last couple decades, and our next guest writes that these changes have made clothes objectively worse in many cases, especially when it comes to quality and durability. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you noticed your clothes wearing out more quickly than they used to? Do you have a favorite old sweater, coat, pair of jeans that really has withstood the test of time? Where do you go to find quality clothes that last nowadays? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Amanda Mull is a staff writer at The Atlantic, where she writes Material World, a regular column on American consumerism. Amanda, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we dig into the whys here, Amanda, sometimes when we say, you know, things aren't as good as they used to be, there's some nostalgia or golden age thinking there. You write, no, there's really something to this. Are our clothes objectively worse than they used to be?
Yes, for clothing specifically, and also really any textile product that you interact with, whether that be, you know, upholstered furniture or blankets or anything like that, the answer is yes, they are absolutely of lower quality in most cases than an equivalent garment would have been, 30 or 40 years ago. Things have changed a lot since then.
You point toward a pivotal moment in the history of how we make clothing in 2005, the end of this international arrangement on the fibers in clothing and where they come from. Can you tell us a little bit about the multi-fiber arrangement?
Yes, that is a trade agreement that ended in 2005 that was purposely phased out from the time that it was signed in the 1970s. While it was in place, held import controls over how much could be brought into the U.S. As far as textile products go from developing countries, from poorer countries. So it made it sort of onerous to bring those products into the United States, and sort of cleared the way both for the American garment industry and for garment industries in countries that are a little bit richer and that have generally better worker and environmental protections. So those products were given preferential treatment, basically, in both imports and in the domestic market. That agreement was phased out by its own structure in 2005, which is where you really see the introduction of a lot of fast fashion into the United States clothing market in particular. You get a lot of imports from countries where labor costs are very, very low, and usually federal governments in those countries are sort of open-minded about what kind of chemicals can be used in textile production, what kind of dyes can be used, what kinds of environmental protections need to be adhered to. So the combination of those things leads to really, really low prices for clothing. It leads to the types of, you know, $9 pants that you can get on Shein or Temu or sometimes on Amazon at this point. And it also leads to products that are made with less skilled labor and made with worse materials, because that has suddenly become possible by opening up these new manufacturing locations to import into the U.S.
Now, when it comes to materials, it seems there's one word, plastics, that we need to talk about. Now, we'd had polyester clothing. I was famous in the 70s and things like that. But you write, we start finding plastic in more and more articles of clothing, even where we wouldn't necessarily expect to see it. Talk about the rise of plastic and the impact that's had.
Yes. Like you said, plastics in clothing aren't new, and they definitely aren't new since the end of the multi-fiber arrangement. But their role in clothing and their preponderance in clothing has definitely changed in that period of time. What you see is garments that you would probably as a consumer assume would be made out of a natural fiber of some sort, that have sort of growing, you know, percentages of plastic in them. And plastic is going to be labeled on your garments as polyurethane, as polyester, as acrylic, as polyamide. There's lots of sort of more technical names for it that all mean plastic, essentially. They're just different types of plastic. So you're going to see that sort of woven into a lot of other garments. Something that you might, you know, assume as a cotton t-shirt might be a cotton poly blend. Something that you might assume as a wool sweater is a wool poly or a wool acrylic blend. So it sort of sneaks into all kinds of textiles in a way that a lot of people don't realize. And then eventually, as prices go down, you just get lots and lots of garments that are fully made out of these textiles.
Talking to Amanda Mull from The Atlantic about the declining quality of the clothing we can buy. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your experiences or your questions. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Our producer, Rochelle, who gave you the call, Amanda, and set up this interview, she had her own clothing nightmare story that made her interested in this topic. She actually said, okay, I'm going to plunk down some extra money from jeans from a reputable company. Higher price, right? Going to mean higher quality? Nope. After less than 6 months of weekly wear, Rochelle says the jeans ripped down the inseam in a non-repairable way. It's happened again with another reputable brand of jeans. So the idea, Amanda, that, okay, if we want to get out of this problem, we'll just go out and buy more expensive stuff. It'll last longer, so I don't keep having to buy more and more. Does that even work anymore?
Not necessarily. What Rochelle experienced is something that I think a lot of people encounter when trying to use price as sort of a guiding principle in figuring out what is good quality and what is not. And that is totally understandable. It's something that a lot of people do because it's very, very hard to figure out as just a casual consumer of clothing if any particular thing that you're looking at is good quality, will stand the test of time. We don't have, you know, as a population, we don't have the technical knowledge necessary to do that. But what you see, even when you look at like very, very high-end designer clothes, what you see is a lot of sort of substandard textiles, a lot of really high plastic content, and, you know, seams that are coming apart, metal hardware that is not attached particularly well, or that is starting to tarnish before it even gets sold. There's all these like little details that sort of can give you a clue about what is going on, but you have to look at every garment really, really closely. And with the amount of clothing that's bought online, sometimes out of convenience, sometimes out of necessity, because there aren't retailers everywhere that carry the types of clothes that people need or the sizes of clothes that people need, you end up having to guess because you can't examine anything that's sold online in person by its very nature. So it's just really, really difficult to tell. And price is, to the extent that it ever was a good indicator of quality, it really no longer is.
You mentioned earlier lower cost labor in many countries around the world. You point out in your piece a race to the bottom. If I'm a manufacturer or importer who's competing on price point, I guess I'm not going to worry about the skill level of my employees. I want people who can do the work cheap and fast. Is that part of what's affecting the end product?
Yes, absolutely. There's nothing inherently wrong with manufacturing anywhere. If a company wants to hire skilled labor and make sure people are trained well and make sure that people, get adequate rest and have adequate working conditions and good machines to use, then you can have good manufacturing anywhere. But companies that are looking to compete on price are looking to keep their numbers generally as low as they possibly can, because that's the only way that you can compete on price in an industry where prices are already sort of like mind-bogglingly low. So you're looking for people that you can extract as much labor from as possible, facilities that will give you the lowest prices as possible, raw materials that cost, as little as possible per yard or per pound, depending on what you're using. So you're looking at all of these sort of like price inputs that go into how much a garment costs. And if you're just like pushing them all as low as you possibly can, there's basically no opportunity for that to yield a good high quality garment, no matter where it's made, no matter the best intentions of the people making it. If you're just looking to spend as little as possible on creating that garment, then you're going to get what you pay for.
Amanda Mull is with us from The Atlantic, where she writes Material World, a regular column on American consumerism. She's with us to talk about why the clothes we buy now in many cases don't last as long as they used to. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you experienced this yourself? Have you observed the decline in the quality of clothing? Where do you buy clothes? Is it online, at the store? Are there brands you trust to have good quality, or are you wondering where to find that kind of quality? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Amanda Mull, staff writer at The Atlantic, about changes to clothes manufacturing over the last couple decades that have made clothing worse, less durable. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring out a caller. Elena is with us in Madison. Elena, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that absolutely I'm noticing that the quality has gone down, even in so-called pure fabrics like cotton. It's made so tissue thin, it's almost like the weave and the fabric is weaker, where I can't get much wear out of a garment for as long, because within a couple of washes or a few wears, it's developing like all kinds of micro holes. I've noticed that there are certain countries of manufacture that this seems to be more prevalent. But, you know, in regard to the question of, you know, how do we resolve this? Where are we looking for quality? I sew casually. And so I was raised to say, well, you know, if you want something quality made, you could make it yourself. But I'm finding that as someone who doesn't professionally sew or isn't a mass distributor, the price of quality fabric that I can go and touch and feel and I know what the blend is and it's something that I would use is so prohibitive to me making my own garment.
Wow.
That I can't compete with my own labor with the price of going and buying that fast fashion. And I was wondering if your guest could speak at all to that.
Elena.
And I'll take that comment off here. Oh,
wow, yes. That's super interesting. Thank you, Elena, for calling. Amanda, what do you have for Elena?
I think she's absolutely correct on all the points she made. Even if you are looking only for garments that are made of cotton, for instance, or other natural fibers, you have to be really, really careful about the source of those natural fibers, because, you know, shrinkflation, as we've seen in lots of like food products and things like that, where the manufacturer sells you something in the same container it's always been in, but it has like a little bit less product, which brings their materials cost down a little bit and like helps their profits. That happens in textiles and garments too, where you get, you know, you get sold, you know, a particular type of cotton fabric, but like maybe the weave isn't as dense. Maybe there isn't as much fiber actually in it. So you get these sort of like thinner, flimsier fabrics. So it isn't just polyester or other types of plastics that that affect the quality of the materials that we're looking at. And then, you know, as she says, it is so difficult to beat the sort of fast fashion machine when it comes to trying to figure out ways around it. Even if you can sew, even if you're quite good and quite skilled in making your own clothing, if you want the really, really high-end fabric, you're buying it in really small quantities. So these companies that are manufacturing all of this clothing overseas, you know, is buying it in enormous bulk. So they really get it down to like very, very inexpensive per yard compared to what we have access to at retail as individuals. So even if it's all your own labor that you're putting into it, it is, if you were like really price conscious and trying to stick to a budget, it is very, very difficult to find a way around this if you want something new. The best way to do it probably is to shop secondhand, whether that's in thrift stores in person or online. But yeah, if you're trying to create like a specific thing, it's usually cheaper just to buy it, which is unfortunate.
Elena, thanks a lot for the call. Jeff joins us now in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Yeah, well, I can be happy to share my male perspective on this. When it comes to my everyday clothing, I go to Menards and, you know, I wear them out and, you know, get another pair of jeans or whatever. But my fancy clothes, I'll go to an outlet mall and I'll find a bargain. Calvin Klein or Eddie Bauer, I have some shirts that are Izod clothing, 25 years old now. And Eddie Bauer is my favorite brand. But what I wanted to say is you can find a bargain when you're looking for style. If you're looking for, you know, the quality and all that, you really do have to shop around, in my opinion.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. Amanda, you mentioned shopping secondhand. Do you have any advice along Jeff's lines for if we are buying new, when we want something quality that we can somehow afford too?
Well, the first thing I would say is that if you have stuff in your closet that's 25 years old that you still like, hold on to it. It is going to be really, really difficult to replace those types of shirts at a reasonable price for the same amount of quality, because things made during that era are just made better, even if they were bought from outlet malls or like a mass brand store or something like that. They are things that were made 25 years ago are almost all better than the equivalent product that you would buy today. And they might have been less expensive even. But yeah, if you are looking to buy something new and looking for really, really good quality, you have to be very, very choosy. And the best way to do this is really to go in person, if at all possible, to hold things in your hand, to feel what the fabric is like, to be able to compare things across brands when you're looking for a particular item. I think the death of shopping malls is greatly exaggerated. Some places are losing them, some places are gaining them. If you can get to a mall, there is a much greater possibility of you walking out with something that you actually wear and like for an extended period of time than if you're just guessing on the internet.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Hope we're not competing at the clearance rack. Molly joins us now in Madison. Molly, hi.
Hi, yeah. I buy the vast majority of my clothes secondhand. And I find that it's a great filter for quality, because things just won't survive to the secondhand stage if they're not of decent make. And of course, that's everything from, you know, Goodwill to your higher end consignment stores.
Now, Molly, I used to do more used clothes shopping. My concern is sometimes, you know, it takes more time, right? You got to really be willing to dig in, shuffle through things to find the thing that's going to fit and still no holes in it. Does that worry you, or do you have a pretty good system?
If there's something I really, really need right now, I'm less likely to find it secondhand, but that's not usually the case. I can usually just kind of keep in mind, the things that I'm looking for, and eventually I'll find them.
Molly, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. And Amanda, you mentioned the idea of secondhand shopping. I've heard there are some concerns, though, with sort of a garbage in, garbage out. If people are putting their fast fashion disintegrating clothing, they're donating it. That's what's going to start showing up on shelves. Is there diminishing returns on secondhand shopping, too?
I think there definitely can be, as more and more fast fashion sort of like washes into the secondhand clothing sales streams. You have to be pretty disciplined about looking at labels, looking at fabric compositions, even in secondhand situations. But secondhand in general, you're always in a better position to find something that might actually be good, because you are looking at products that are produced over a whole range of eras, from a whole range of brands, much wider than you would be able to find at like a single store that you might go to otherwise that was selling new stuff. So I think that there's vigilance required for secondhand shopping, but I think that often that can actually be good. Like, it sounds like an inconvenience, but I think that it can actually lead to a lot better decision making, because it forces you to slow down and really think about something and really consider your options and consider if you might actually wear that thing. And because, you know, it's harder to return things. There's fewer sizes, fewer colors available of any particular thing. So I think it, like, the constraints of secondhand shopping can sometimes be really useful.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Amanda Mull from The Atlantic about the decline in quality in the clothing we buy. Back to your calls. Tom is with us in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. A few decades ago, I used to be able to buy very high quality wool pants, also wool shirts, but largely the pants for outdoor use or indoor use. Have people just preferred different materials, or has it been the price? I'm wondering what's going on with wool.
Tom, thanks for the call. Amanda, you wrote a whole piece about sweaters where the decline in wool was part of that. Is Tom right? Are we using less and less wool?
Yes. Wool usage has definitely gone down. And I think that there's a few reasons for that. The first reason is that the wool is just the type of product that there's not like an absolutely endless supply of. When you are an apparel company, even if you're not a fast fashion company, you're probably looking to sell things at a pretty large scale. If you are a modern clothing brand, there's just not an endless supply of wool. So wool tends to be more expensive than its sort of like polyester and acrylic counterparts. And so you're probably going to switch down to like a less expensive fabric that can be, you know, can be bought in pretty much endless quantities that are available on the market right now. So wool is just like more scarce. And also, like, people have gotten a little bit weird about wool from the consumer angle. People are afraid of it because it has to be dry cleaned, or it has to be hand washed, or you have to be very careful with it in the washing machine. And people are sort of used to being able to throw everything in and sort of set it and forget it when washing their clothes. And they feel like it's giving them extra chores or extra errands, which I totally get. If you're not in the habit of doing that, it can be a real problem. So a lot of consumers tend to look for things that are just like easy machine washable. So you get a consumer preference away from wool in some situations because of that, which makes buying the sort of more expensive textile to use in these garments less interesting to clothing brands, which overall over time gets you just less wool, period.
Thanks for the call, Tom. And just our last half a minute, Amanda, you know, we could boycott one brand and then buy from another brand that does exactly the same stuff. What would it take to change this downward spiral of clothing?
I think that there are really only two things that affect how these clothing manufacturers and clothing brands act. The first thing is just regulation. We had a preponderance of good quality, well-priced natural fiber clothing in, you know, a couple generations ago, because there were regulatory statutes put in place that guaranteed that we would have those things in the United States. And when those laws went away, we stopped having them. So there's a one-to-one correlation on what regulation can do for you if you want good, high quality things. And then there's also the consumer behavior effects, how these brands act. And, you know, as you said, switching from one brand to another that does the exact same thing probably is not necessarily effective, but sort of finding ways to buy less overall, to sort of divest from the constant sort of cycle of buying more and staying on trend. And
then we'll leave it there. Thanks to Amanda Mull for The Atlantic, looking at declining quality of clothing in the shops that we buy clothes at.